Good morning, everyone. It's always interesting to see the way the light shines in each of your little Zoom boxes, depending on where your windows are. Tomorrow is the solstice. And the days will start getting longer, we will have more light, and that will lift our spirits, I imagine. Hang on, did I turn this on? I think so. I seem to have created a tradition of doing a Dharma talk around this time about joy. And that's, I guess, partly because, you know, of the old Christmas carols that ring in my mind, tidings of comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. And I always think, you know, sadly, it's not necessarily a joyous time for a lot of people. Whether or not they celebrate Christmas, as a Christian holiday, the Christmas stuff, the Christmas paraphernalia, you know, it surrounds us, and we're influenced by that, and it can be a lonely time for those who are separate from their families for whatever reason, whether it's geographical distance, displacement, or death, or estrangement. And it can also be a stressful time, even for those who are going to spend the holidays with their families, because all kinds of family issues arise. You know, how do you divide it between the two different sets of in-laws, right? Family expectations and conflicts arise. And then there are just the pressures of the consumer culture around the holidays. It can be a too busy time. So maybe our pandemic Christmas, our pandemic holidays, will give people a chance to have to let some of that go and have a quieter time over the holidays and find ways to be rest and be nourished, and creative ways to connect with friends and families as well. So, once again, I'm going to talk about joy, especially now as we're well into the 10th month of the pandemic, and so many of us are in need of that sort of deep rest and restoration from the strain and fatigue of it all. One of those old carols goes, "Joy to the world," right? And of course, the words that come right after that are, "The Lord has come," referring to the birth of Jesus, come to redeem the sins of the world through his life and death. Now, far be it from me to attempt to reframe the story of Jesus Christ, the Christ story, in Buddhist terms, though one could do that, I think, and probably it has been done, but I'll save that for another day. That's a pretty ambitious thing to attempt. What I do want to do is acknowledge that joy is part of our human emotional repertoire, and it is included in Buddhist practice. Buddhism has often been critiqued by those who I'm not sure fully have fully investigated, but critiqued as being a rather grim and joyless religion because of the focus on suffering. But of course, the Buddha did not want us to dwell in suffering. The whole point was to have a freedom, a way to live in a world of suffering, to be in and of this world, and also free, to have a resilience and freedom of heart and mind. And joy is a natural upwelling of that freedom. Joy is one of the Brahma-viharas, or noble abodes of loving-kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. The Pali word mudita means gladness, and it's often translated as sympathetic or empathetic joy, which is joy in the happiness and well-being of others. You know, so it's that we cultivate that so that we're not so focused on our own happiness and getting what we want. This practice of mudita is particularly important in balancing compassion, because compassion, especially if we find it relatively easy to empathize with others' suffering, our compassion can become heavy and overwhelming, and maybe some of us have felt that in these months. And so that's where joy and also equanimity in this set of Brahma-viharas practices really have an important role to play to balance and sustain us. So, as I said, the traditional practice of mudita focuses on feeling joy in the well-being and happiness of others. So we begin by calling to mind a dear friend, someone who towards whom it's easy to feel joy in their well-being. And then we focus on a benefactor, someone who has been helpful and supportive to us. So again, it's relatively easy. And then we pick a neutral person, and that's I love practicing these Brahma-viharas with a neutral person. Somebody I hardly know, but I can picture their face. And after really doing that for a while, they feel very dear, this neutral person. And then having kind of flexed your mudita muscles and expanded your capacity, you practice with a difficult person, someone who has caused you or others harm even. And when you're doing that practice, you don't have to cultivate joy in that person's distorted happiness, that person's greed, or, you know, harmful, what they might perceive as their benefit or their happiness. What you do is you try and zero in on something, some way that they feel a relatively pure happiness, you know, towards their grandchild, for example, or their pet, their dog or cat, and you feel that capacity in them, right? And you feel glad about that, and you want that to flourish in them, or their joy in a sunset, or feeling their body be well running, for example. So if if it's a person you know, you try and notice their feeling of well-being, a wholesome well-being, and be glad in that. Sharon Salzberg, who's a Vipassana teacher who has spent decades teaching these practices, claims that joy is the hardest one, actually, of the four to practice, because there are so many obstacles to it. So I'm just going to review. Some of you heard me do this before, but it bears repetition. I'm just going to review what those obstacles are so we can catch ourselves and realize this is a joy blocker, and just let it go a little, huh? So first big one is judgment, right? We want people and things to be the way we want them to be, right? And judgment arises from what? Comparing mind. Better than, worse than, just as good as, all, you know, self-referenced comparison. We are always gauging in that way. And the Buddha taught that all that activity of comparing mind is self-conceit or self-clinging. And so you can easily see how that comparing mind prevents you from feeling joy in the well-being of others, right? It's pretty hard to feel joy if you're feeling, better than, worse than. You know, when that person's getting the promotion or the recognition or the approval or the good reviews that you're not getting, right? You may have noticed how sibling rivalry surfaces around times of holidays, also weddings and funerals. You know, mom or dad always liked you best. Another joy killer. Envy. Right? Envy comes from that core feeling of deprivation, of not enough. And envy can be so consuming, debilitating. If you've ever really been in the grip of envy, it's kind of a hell realm and definitely a joy killer. So in some people, this comparing mind then leads to a habit of putting others down, demeaning others in order not to feel inferior oneself. Or, on the other hand, if we habitually demean ourselves, that makes joy in others' well-being equally impossible. So no matter which way you turn it, it hinders the arising of joy. Yeah? And then there's prejudice, the way that we shut others out of our heart based on some kind of fixed or narrow view. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once wrote, "If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we should find in each one's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." I think practicing with the Brahma Viharas is a way that we disarm our hostility, our defendedness, even without knowing the secret histories of those who seem to be our enemies or in opposition to us. We can't always know those secret histories, but we can trust and know that causes and conditions led to that person's behavior or speech that we felt was harmful to us or threatened us in some way. We can know that. So there's another obstacle to joy, is one that you might not think of, and it's boredom or apathy, which is essentially in the realm of aversive states, right? It's a turning away from experience. It's saying, you know, this is annoying, or this is not interesting, or, you know, this is not worthy of my attention, or this is, you know, we're kind of rejecting our present experience when in states of boredom or apathy. And when we do that, when we turn away from those little experiences, we are also turning away from the myriad small sources of gladness and joy, because we're going to miss them. We're going to not pay attention because we're bored, right? Yeah. When we are truly open to that vividly alive present moment, our own happiness and the happiness of others will not be separate. We'll smile at others' well-being and happiness just the same way when we do when we see a little child absorbed in play. You know, you spontaneously smile, right? I like to think that we can extend this practice of mudita, of sympathetic joy, to that kind of spontaneous resonance that we feel with the life force of other beings. So not only human beings, but bumblebees, red cedar trees, chickadees. You know, there's this spontaneous response to that liveliness that we feel. And I think that's sympathetic joy too. But when those hindrances of craving, fear, aversion, envy, agitation, sluggishness, doubt, all those hindrances, when they cloud our naturally clear mind, they obstruct joy, and when they drop away, we open to this sort of natural connection, natural arising of joy. And a kind of lightness and openness comes, and we can live in the world with an expanded field of awareness that allows us to enter into each moment with a vivid interest. And that is whether it's conventionally pleasant or unpleasant. So here's where we're getting into joy can arise right in the middle of really painful circumstances, really challenging circumstances. But there's this way that the vivid aliveness of that moment still can generate joy. And that's the joy that it's so easy to miss in our sort of frantic dance with the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, endlessly pursuing one and trying to avoid the other. But there are times when we can stop and listen. Open our senses, open our hearts and minds, and a simple, simple quiet joy arises, even in the midst of hard times. And this kind of openness is what we cultivate in our practice. And sometimes we do it deliberately. We have to do it deliberately. We can teach ourselves joy. And sometimes we have to make a special effort in dark times. Now, some of you, I'm sure, have heard me read this quote from Barbara, the novelist Barbara Kingsolver, but it's just one of my favorite quotes. So if you've heard it before, please bear with me and enjoy it. Every one of us is called on probably many times to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job, or a limb, or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. And notice these changes, she's saying, are not all negative. There are things that we think are positive, but they can shake us up, right? In my own worst seasons, I've come back from a colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window. And then another, my daughter in a yellow dress. And another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learned to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again. So we can do that. We can do that. As I have mentioned before on occasion, what teaches me joy on a daily basis is hummingbirds at our feeder, right outside our window where we have our breakfast and in the morning. The Chilean poet and artist Cecilia Vicuña says that reflections are prayers of light. Reflections are prayers of light. The message is light. The iridescent hummingbird is the messenger. She translates a song, Song of the Hummingbird, from the indigenous Guarani people into Spanish. I'm going to try and read it in Spanish because I love how it sounds. ¿Tienes algo que comunicar, colibri? Lanza rayos el colibri. El jugo de tus flores evidentemente te ha mareado, colibri. Lanza rayos, colibri. So here it is in English. translated by her translator. I always like to recognize the translators. Suzanne Jill Levine. Have something to say, hummingbird. Hummingbird flashes rays of light. The juice from your flowers has made you dizzy. Hummingbird flashes rays of light. Song of the Hummingbird. But sometimes it seems that the more we reach for joy, you know, like we want it, the more it eludes us. Sometimes we need to let it take us by surprise. William Wordsworth used that phrase to title a poem, Surprised by Joy. And then C.S. Lewis adopted it to title a book, Surprised by Joy. Both of them describing the feeling of a spontaneous return of the life force after deep, obliterating grief. And this kind of joy tends to be tinged a little bit with the sadness of being unable to share it with the loved one who is no longer there. But as time goes on, there's a sweetness of that memory. So it's a sadness-tinged sweet joy that can come with healing after a deep loss. Joy so close to sorrow at times. Wordsworth closes a different poem, a famous poem called Tintern Abbey, with these lines. With an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. We could just tweak that a little, and it would be Dharma words. Seeing with the Dharma eye of stillness, compassion, and equanimity, we see into the life of things, and joy emerges. So I think poets express these qualities of joy better than most. So I always like to share some poems when I do this talk. And so I wanted to choose poems this time of joy arising in out of hard times. So this one is very short. It's by the Black American poet Lucille Clifton, who knew, she's no longer living, she's a 20th century poet, who knew, as so many Black mothers and grandmothers still know today, how close danger is for their sons and grandsons. It's called Photograph. My grandsons spinning in their joy. Universe, keep them turning, turning. Black blurs against the window of the world, for they are beautiful, and there is trouble coming, round and round and round. I think you could sing that poem. That's a poem that could be sung. Here's one by the American poet Donald Hall. It's called Summer Kitchen. In June's high light, she stood at the sink with a glass of wind and listened for the bobolink and crushed garlic in late sunshine. I watched her cooking from my chair. She pressed her lips together, reached for kitchenware, and tasted sauce from her fingertips. It's ready now, come on, she said. You light the candle. We ate and talked and went to bed and slept. It was a miracle. Now, you wouldn't just from the surface know that that poem is about hard times, unless you knew that his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, who was 19 years younger than he, died of leukemia at the age of 47 after a long illness, and she had suffered from depression for her entire life and wrote luminous, unsentimental poetry throughout her difficult life. And even if you didn't know that, the poem communicates the miraculous beauty, the ephemeral beauty of a simple meal prepared with love. Remember how we talked about miracles during Sesshin? The power of the simple powers of chopping wood and carrying water and cooking a meal. These are the kinds of miracles we have experienced during the long months of the pandemic. I'm sure, I hope, that each of you could think of one. Sometimes we just look out our window, right? And something opens, something shifts. Here's one by Raymond Carver. It's called Happiness. And it might as well be called Joy. So early, it's still almost dark out. I'm near the window with coffee and the usual early morning stuff that passes for thought. When I see the boy and his friend walking up the road to deliver the newspaper, they wear caps and sweaters, and one boy has a bag over his shoulder. They are so happy they aren't saying anything, these boys. I think if they could, they would take each other's arm. It's early in the morning, and they are doing this thing together. They come on slowly. The sky is taking on light, though the moon still hangs pale over the water. Such beauty that for a minute, death and ambition, even love, doesn't enter into this. Happiness, it comes on unexpectedly and goes beyond, really, any early morning talk about it. So again, that's not one that you would know comes out of hardship. But Carver's another poet and master of the short story, who was intimate with suffering. He struggled with severe alcoholism for years, divorce, bankruptcy, before in his later years achieving a measure of stability in his loving relationship with the poet Tess Gallagher. After his death, he'd lived a hard life and his body eventually failed before he reached old age. After his death, Tess Gallagher made a trip to Japan. And this is a poem that came from that trip. It's called Yes. Now that we are like that flat cone of sand in the garden of the Silver Pavilion in Kyoto, designed to appear only in moonlight, do you want me to mourn? Do you want me to wear black? Or like moonlight on whitest sand, to use your dark to gleam, to shimmer? I gleam, I mourn. Gleaming in the darkness. Is some of this starting to resonate with that chant that we do, right? In light there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness, right? In darkness there is light. Okay, I'm going to read you another one. This is the last one I'll read. By the great poet of shadow and light, Holocaust survivor Paul Celan. One critic has commented that Celan is perhaps more invoked than read, more read than comprehended. So don't feel like you should understand this one. Just, it's short. Just hear it as you hear the chant, the poem that we do, merging of difference and unity, or identity of relative and absolute. I can never remember which translation we use. This is Celan's poem. Speak, you too. Speak as the last. Say out your say. Speak, but don't split off no from yes. Give your say this meaning too. Give it the shadow. Give it shadow enough. Give it as much as you know is spread round you from midday to midday and midnight. Sorry, midnight to midday and midnight. Look around. See how things all come alive. By death, alive. Speak true who speaks shadow. I'm going to read you just a little bit more, and this is by a poet who edited an anthology of poems called Joy. His name's Christian Wiemann. And this is from his introduction. And he talks about the difference between happiness and joy. And he says that in the literature, you know, sort of philosophical literature, the two are often distinguished sharply. It says, happiness is a disposition or evaluation. We are happy when we experience pleasure, when things go our way, and so on. Joy, by contrast, is an emotion. There is always an element of having been seized, you know, surprised, right? The unexpected. Happiness involves enlarging or securing the self. You're happy when you pay off your mortgage or get a raise. Joy, by contrast, always involves some loss of self. From the parent reveling in the autonomous existence of her child to the contemplative lost in religious ecstasy. But then he goes on and says, I'm not sure the distinction is quite so sharp. And then he gives some examples of poems in the book where happiness goes beyond happiness. Or joy is a dissolving of self and other. He says, in any event, poetry does not usually refine philosophical definitions so much as weaken one's need to see them. Even as it strengthens the intuitive trust, tolerance for paradox, and general spiritual fluency that are required to thrive without such definitions. Did you follow that? Poetry does not usually refine those philosophical definitions, happiness versus joy, so much as weaken our need to even see them, and to strengthen the trust and tolerance for paradox and fluency that are required to thrive without such definitions. And I thought, wow, he's talking about our practice. He's talking about our practice. Those are the very capacities that give us resilience in hard times. We cultivate them through our practice of moment-to-moment awareness, turning towards our experience with unconditional openness. And in this, then we have the capacity to be surprised by joy, right in the middle of times of hardship. And this joy has no price tag. And it can be shared in the moment, if you're in the company of a friend, or later, as these poets have, offering up their experience, as artists do, or simply offering it right now. So after we close and do our service, we're going to do our round of greetings, as we usually do. I'm going to invite each of you to offer a little joy to everybody here. A little moment. So think of it, be specific, you know, not a generality, but an actual little experience of joy. It doesn't have to be earth-shaking, but something from your own experience. So I'm just giving you a heads up so you can see what percolates up as we chant now. So, joy to the world, joy. Oh, there's that. I think last year we sang that song, that funny song, joy to the world. Yeah, I don't know if I can. I can't do it without a little preparation. Joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea. Joy to you and me. That one, that funny song. Sort of a country rock. We'll do that again another year. We did that last year. I just remembered. I totally forgot. Okay, let's do our end of Dharma talk chant. Joy to the world. Joy to you and me. May our...